Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome to this inaugural professorial lecture of Professor John Barry. I'm David Finnemore. I'm head of the School of Politics, International Studies and Philosophy, and it's my privilege to be hosting this evening's lecture. As I said, welcome. Welcome to colleagues, to John's family and friends, and to a number of students in the audience as well. I'm delighted, as I'm sure John is, to see you all here for an event which marks John's thoroughly deserved promotion to the rank of professor. Okay, particular welcome is extended to John's wife Yvonne and to his two daughters Saoirse and Derbla, and to John's parents Liz and Jack, as well as other members of John's family. I'm sure for all of you this is a very proud day. I think for you, Liz and Jack, it must be a particularly proud occasion, seeing John, who 30 years ago started out on his academic career at UCD studying, wait for it, maths, French and economics, standing here now following degrees at UCD and a PhD from the University of Glasgow as a professor of green political economy, and as far as we are aware, the only professor of green political economy. I'm also delighted to be introducing the inaugural professorial lecture of such an established, engaging, and I think exceedingly active academic colleague. I genuinely feel honoured. It's hosting and introducing such an occasion is undoubtedly one of the more enjoyable and privileged roles that a head of school gets to perform. Most of you know John, will know John very well and be very familiar with his ideas, with what he has written, with his interests, his passions, his politics, his enthusiasm for his teaching and research, with his activism, with his knowledge, and with his undoubted commitment to challenging conventions and engaging in debate. For those of you less familiar with John's academic work, or not fully aware of how extensive it is, it can only impress. He has written, co-written, or co-edited 14 books, including most recently The Politics of Actually Existing Unsustainability, Human Flourishing in a Climate Changed, Carbon Constrained World. Some good titles, John. As well as being a co-author of the first encyclopedia in the field of environmental politics. He's also the author of over 50 chapters in edited volumes and almost as many articles in learned journals. The range of his research interests and established expertise is equally impressive. Two areas stand out, and he will be engaging with these, with both of these in his lecture this evening. Firstly, normative and theoretical aspects of the politics of sustainability and sustainable development. And then, secondly, the empirical and policy-related studies, the politics and economics of the transition to sustainability, including work on post-growth economics and low-carbon, post-carbon energy policy. He also, I don't know where he finds the time, to be honest, conducts research and writes on the contemporary politics of Ireland, Northern Ireland, generally with a focus on issues of political economy, sustainable development and working class issues. While very much based in politics and political theory, John is an explicitly interdisciplinary scholar. So he has conducted research and published widely with colleagues both within and outside Queen's from other disciplines, ranging from engineering, environmental planning and law, to management, environmental science, philosophy and sociology. He also has a genuinely international reputation as one of the leading global scholars in the area of green political and economic theory. Proof of his status can be found in the extensive citation of the work he's done, the invitations to present at international conferences and workshops, his examination of PhDs which have used or engaged with his work, and a whole host of invitations to co-author publications or become a partner in research projects. He's also very much an engaged scholar, sharing his work with the non-academic community and media. As I'm sure most of you are aware, he's a regular speaker at community and civil society and policy events in Northern Ireland and beyond. And he is, as I'm sure everybody is very much aware, very active as a member of the Green Party in local politics. What always strikes me about John as an academic colleague is his fervent and exceptionally knowledgeable interest in the topics and interests and issues he researches, and in his ability to convey his enthusiasm to others, whether students or colleagues. I think this is particularly so when it comes to issues of vital relevance to contemporary society and the future of the world in which we live. John never shies away from confronting his audiences with uncomfortable truths and options. In doing so, he fulfills a vitally important role of a publicly engaged academic. I think it's fair to say we will be presented with some of those uncomfortable truths this evening in what John is about to present. So, again, welcome everybody. John, many congratulations on the promotion to professor. Can I now invite you to present your inaugural lecture entitled Carbon Capitalism and the Transition from Unsustainability, the Challenge for Civilization in the 21st Century. John.
Thank you. Thank you, David, and great to see so many people here. Before I begin, formally I want to thank some people, first of all to David for his welcome, my colleagues here at Queen's and elsewhere, with whom I've developed my ideas. Secondly, is students who've had the pleasure or horror of having me teach or supervise them, from whom I've learnt and stolen their ideas in equal measure. To my parents, my father, for whom I have a naive commitment to honesty and telling the truth, and my mother, from whom I have my antipathy to housework, and probably above all, my high energy levels. And at last, my immediate family, my daughters Saoirse and Dervla, whose future animates much of my academic and political work to help create a better world for them. And finally, my wife Yvonne, my partner, with whom I share credit. She has suffered patiently my frequent absences, and as a constant reminder to me that there are more important things to life than politics, and life is not a seminar. This is a night of firsts. It's the first time many of you perhaps see me not just wear a suit, but that I do possess a pair of long trousers. I'm dressing tonight because of my political adage of always dressing to the right and voting to the left. But perhaps this might also be the first professorial inaugural lecture given by somebody who's technically an industrial action. More of that later. I offer you here tonight. I offer you here tonight the reverse of the old adage that as one gets older, one's waist gets thicker as one's mind gets thinner. Well, I've certainly fulfilled the waist bit. But I find myself more radical now than I was when I started off 30-odd years ago under the supervision of Professor John Baker here from University College Dublin and my master's dissertation on limits to growth. I hope to confuse, amuse and provoke you in equal measure tonight and to encourage you all that you should perhaps in a small measure be like me and become radical in how we make the transition to a more sustainable economy. So some intellectual health and safety warnings before I begin. I won't read these out. These are my instruction manuals to myself when I teach, particularly the first one. Exaggeration is when the truth loses its temper. And the last one. I will have something to say in terms of what I think are the obligations of the academic in this time of crisis and great change. Us privileged knowledge workers, how are we applying our knowledge to our community? How are we making the world a better place? And most importantly, because I'll be spending quite a bit of time on critiquing what I think is a cancer in modern society of not just capitalism, but another C, consumerism. Just to let you know. Are you all sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin. I begin from the position of being an environmentalist, which is the crazy idea that we should clean up after ourselves and pass on the world in a better state than that which we found it. Everything I give you tonight has been said by Dr. Seuss. The original film, not the one that came later. I speak for the trees. But is green the new red? And that'll be part of what I'll be looking at in terms of some of the older ideas of social justice, of social transformation, of class, of inequality, most of which have fallen off the political agenda. I think I've come back with a greater relevance now in dealing with issues of unsustainability. And this is what we're dealing with. A vision for Mordor if the Canadian tar sands goes ahead. A vision of our future on a planet that we're frying. Hence our rather clement weather we have here this evening. This is all part of the projections for climate change for this part of the world. A world that's literally dripping in oil and blood for oil, as I'll point out. And we're essentially degrading the planet's resources quicker than it could sustain and regenerate. We are living in a thoroughly unsustainable world. And I'll make the claim that that's what we should begin from. Not arguments for sustainability, but arguments for unsustainability. And this sustainability comes in different shapes and sizes. This is a map adjusted in terms of world military spending. The money required to eradicate poverty and hunger, just in terms of the other dimension of what you might call social unsustainability. Where are we putting those creative human talents, the collective labour, our technologies in terms of sustaining life as opposed to finding better ways to kill each other? And a question I find myself asking again and again, why is there always money for war and yet we can't eradicate poverty or find the money for education? And is green, therefore, the new red? We are on a ship. This is the good ship, Karl Marx. And whether or not is it towards a Marxism that we need to go back to or reinvigorate in the 21st century to at least chart some of the problems, if not agree completely with all the prognoses and diagnoses and solutions that classical Marxism had identified in terms of the problems with capitalism. It has also been seen by the opponents of environmentalism and green politics, of which my colleague James McCarroll from North Down Board of Council will probably testify that I'm regularly accused of on North Down Council. I think it is my habit of calling everybody comrade, might give it away. And I do think that this is a common view of green politics. And my answer to this is, so what? If green is the new red, what is the issue in terms of that perhaps being the framework within which we have to look at sustainability? This is probably an image of me. This is the watermelon green. Green on the outside and red in the middle. But the context that we're looking at this issue of the transition from unsustainability is the proliferation, zombie economics, of dead ideas, capitalist economics, or to give it a more technical term, neoclassical economics, which have comprehensively failed to predict the global economic crash of 2007-2008, failed to find solutions beyond bailing out the banks, which is the socialism of the rich, a private sector financial crisis. I'm looking at my colleague Andrew Baker to see if he's nodding, to see if I'm getting this right. A private sector banking crisis becomes, with a sleight of hand, into a public sector funding crisis. And that's the context in which we face another dimension of unsustainability. I'm using this image up here as a reference to how consumerism was based upon debt. And that was the great engine of the pre-crash model. And in many respects, most political parties, the dominant analysis of our economic crisis is rather like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz clicking her ruby red slippers. Get us back to 2008, back to 2008, back onto consumption and consumerism. And whether or not that is the model that we have to go back to. But I also think, no relation, Wendell Berry's comment here I think is very apposite in terms of the deep ethical and political choices that we have as a society. Our leaders have the courage to send our young people off to war, often war for resources or oil, but not the courage to face us, the polis, our people, and say, let's rein in our overconsumption. Let's try and find a new economic model and a new vision of human flourishing. And most of what I have to say to you is based on this book here I wrote 2 years ago that David mentioned. And I think this is very telling. This is an installation in Berlin of politicians talking about climate change. And we're coming up to yet another eco-diplomacy in Paris in terms of whatever deal can be made. And there's some good news today in terms of China and America coming to some interim agreement between themselves in terms of cutting carbon. But I begin, and what's animated all my academic work and indeed my political activism, is a deep sense of injustice and railing against the injustices of the world and trying to figure out what's the cause of that. That's why I always talk about unsustainability. I know it doesn't trip off the tongue, but to me it is the condition in which we live. Just as it is an injustice, rather than justice is the state of the world, it's unsustainability, not sustainability, is the situation that we exist in. But yet the vast majority of the scholarship in my area, which is a fairly modest area when I began 30 years ago, it's now massively increased, a lot more sophistication, technical detail and empirical evidence, was always about sustainability and sustainable development. And my view is that sustainability beckons to the future of some ideal sustainable relationship between humans and the natural world, and a just relationship within human society, whereas unsustainability calls our attention to the present harms that are going on within society and the harms being perpetrated on the non-human world. And of course, they are related, but I think we do need to begin from recognising the priority of unsustainability. And while I am a radical, I'm an evidence-based radical who certainly believes that the perfect, the sustainable, shouldn't become the enemy of the good. How do we make society less unsustainable? And for me, they invariably go hand in hand. Usually, unsustainability between humans and nature is evidence, other things being equal, of an injustice within human society, with nature as the tool by which this is perpetrated. So injustice and unsustainability, to me, are inextricably linked. I think that language of justice, and many of you here come from the political world, the activist world, or the academic world, where we know the power of injustice. The language of justice and injustice is the most powerful ethical language that we have to articulate our claim. So when somebody makes a claim of justice or injustice, we know it's a very serious issue in terms of using that particular moral language. And the reality here is, just to get a bit technical, is that the struggle against injustice is not necessarily the same as the positive struggle for some conception of justice. And I quote here from the political philosopher Thomas Simon. It's got a different phenomenology, justice and injustice. And I would certainly agree with the bit I've bolded there, is that injustice should take priority over justice. And yet most of political theory, certainly since the 1960s, has been, to use the most famous book to come out in post-war political philosophy, A Theory of Justice by John Rawls, and not actually attending to the, in my view, sufficiently the issues of injustice. So for me, explaining where I've come from, that I believe green politics, green political theory and economy must begin from this perception and activism around challenging injustice and unsustainability. And therefore, challenging unsustainability should take priority over coming up with some new green print or blueprint of a just society. Some of the dangers of asking too many questions and being too radical to get to the root of an issue. What this means, though, is that the critique of how unsustainable and unjust our contemporary society and economy actually is does not have to depend on some positive conception of a perfectly just and sustainable world. Now, while of course, and I speak here partly as a political activist and a politician, you can win people over, and it's strategically important to present them with a vision of the good, the sustainable and the just. From my point of view, normatively, ethically, you do not need a positive conception of justice or sustainability in order for your critique of unsustainability and injustice to hold true. Again, to quote Thomas Simon, the negative recommendation stands on its own. You cannot dismiss a critique of injustice under capitalism. You cannot condemn and dismiss a critique of the inequality, the unsustainability under capitalism by simply saying, where's your perfect solution? The identification of harms is sufficient, in order to mobilise action and should be listened to and taken seriously. So what's the cause of all this injustice and unsustainability? Exhibit one, my lord, capitalism. I adopt, for those of you who know this area, which may be about three of us in the room, Karl Polanyi's wonderful book, The Great Transformation, about the disembedding, that capitalism represents historically the disembedding of the human economy to the market, which is simply set by the self-regulating processes of prices, and disembedding the human economy from the environment, but most importantly, disembedding the human economy from social norms and indeed government regulation, as this process of disembedding speeds up under neoliberalism in the last 30 years or so. And particularly as an academic, it pains me greatly, to say the least, to think that the economic learning, the imaginary, how we imagine the economy is, how we construct it, the models we build from it, the prognosis of how the economy should be organised, in learned institutions like universities is extremely poor. Extremely poor. When I was an undergraduate economics student in UCD in the 1980s, we were at least given, although very badly, because he then went on to become very important in the PDs, the Progressive Democrats down south, but we were taught at least Marxist economics, or laborious economics, as this particular lecturer used to call it. We were given some sense of the history of economics and political economy, that the roots of modern economics lie in theology, in ethics, in morals, that Adam Smith was not a right-wing nut job whose only legacy to the world of politics and academia is a rising tide raises all boats, or the wealth of nations. I don't know, here James perhaps agree with me. In the Scottish Enlightenment tradition in which Smith was writing, he wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments prior to writing The Theory of the Wealth of Nations, in that he understood that the importance of embedding the economy and economic norms couldn't be left to themselves. But what we have in the modern academic community, in my view, is a dominant view of economics, with a dominant view of the human being at the centre of a homo economicus, a selfish, self-maximising, self-actualising, independent, rapacious, consumptive human being. This is not to say that we are not at times some of those things. Certainly I am consumptive when there's alcohol involved. But the point is, this is only a partial view of the human being. We are so much more than this particular image that we get under what I'm calling here neoclassical economics. Yet this is what we are producing in the academy right across the Western world. Thousands of what I would call technically competent barbarians. Students who come out with a view of economics that is capitalist economics because they know no other. They've not been taught feminist economics. They have no sense at all of the history of economics. So in which they come out and simply see themselves as managers of a system, and above all else, and nothing riles me more than a man kicking a mule, than an economist who pretends they are objective. As if economics is not as value-laden as Marxism, as feminism, as conservatism, as nationalism. Economics pretends, to a sleight of hand, that it is value-free. There is no value-free economics. Everything is political economy. The economy is intrinsically connected to issues of power, property relations, the conditions under which we organise our productive capacities, we distribute and we consume. So there is no such thing, in my view, as value-free economics. But particularly in a society and an institution like the academy, where we prize variety, we prize pluralism, we prize debate, we don't see any debate around economics. And this is not to say that my version of economics, green political economy, is the correct one, although of course it is. But I'm not saying necessarily that is the only option we have, but let's have the debate between the neoclassical economist, the feminist economist, the Marxist, the eco-Marxist, the Keynesian, the post-Keynesian. So it is the weaker element of my argument here is really just about pluralism. Where do we see the debate and particularly telling, we no longer have at Queen's a school or department of economics. We have a management school. I rest my case. And part of the problem, why I'm so down on capitalism, is that it's addicted to economic growth as a structural condition. This is not to say that all capitalists and entrepreneurs are somehow sitting like a James Bond villain, sitting in a high-backed chair stroking a cat saying, how can I wreck the planet and exploit workers on the way? Well, there may be a few of those, but I don't think that necessarily is an accurate description even of, you know, high-wealth entrepreneurs. This is a structural issue that the capitalist economy has to go or grow or collapse. It's like a bicycle, although not as sustainable. The issue is that what I'm calling here orthodox, undifferentiated economic growth as a permanent feature of the human economy, I'll come back to this, is the primary policy goal of most states, most parties, most governments, and indeed most citizens accept this as a common sense. And I want to return to that notion of the common sense, that this is the only option we have available to us. But here's the thing. From a scientific point of view, whether you look at ecological degradation or the carbon intensity in the atmosphere which is causing climate change, there's a fundamental contradiction between a growing capitalist economy using more resources, more energy, causing more pollution, and the non-negotiable ecological limits of the planet. But it wasn't bad enough. This economic growth also, in the Western world at least, we have some evidence to suggest, it's past the point where it's adding to our well-being. Economic growth has now become uneconomic growth. Growth for its own sake is the ideology of the cancer cell. And I would say that in the Western world, certainly, we have now passed into the stage of cancerous growth. It wasn't as bad as that. The final issue with economic growth, if you're an egalitarian, which I certainly am, I don't know what everybody in the audience is, but I presume quite a proportion perhaps would be, if you're an egalitarian and you're concerned about the issues of inequality and injustice in our society, economic growth is not perhaps often the best way of eradicating or dealing with that. Because economic growth manages and requires socioeconomic inequality rather than eradicating it, which I'll give you some evidence in a moment. So, some basic sustainability. The human economy is a subsystem of the larger ecosystem. Everything that human beings have ever made, ever done, exchange, has been a combination of using human labour, ingenuity, in conjunction with natural resources. The planet isn't growing. So how can a subsystem of a non-growing larger system continually grow? And from a technical point of view, the capitalist economy has to grow by at least 3% per annum just to stay still. What that means, folks, is every 25 years it doubles. So it sounds very modest, 3% a year. But if you stretch it out, we're talking about the doubling of the economy, resources, energy, pollution, every 25 years. This is the human economy here. We get resources in, wastes come out. If that grows, we get more resources in, more wastes out. And so there's a fundamental illogical connection between a growing subsystem and a larger system that does not grow. And what we're in now is a state of global ecological overshoot. Although it varies, sometime around the mid-90s or late 1980s, we passed as a species the point beyond which we are actually staying within the planet's biocapacity. That's its capacity to regenerate and maintain resources, maintain a functioning ecosystem. We're in overshoot. We're in ecological debt. We've gone into the red since the last 30 years or so. And while we are, as I say here, using the Earth's capital rather than income, so one example of this would be in terms of energy, solar radiation is a form of income. We get that all the time, every day. Capital, on the other hand, is something like oil, coal or gas, which should all be properly seen as ancient sunlight. Oil, coal and gas are ancient sunlight that's been captured through processes over millions of years. It's a form of capital because once you burn up a bag of coal or gallon of oil, it ain't coming back around in any time scale that's meaningful for human beings. Unlike the wind, wave, water power, which are renewable in terms of this issue of being income as opposed to capital. And if we keep going the way we're going, as the Chinese saying puts it, we're going to get to where we're headed. If we stay on our current trajectory of energy, materials, consumption, growth, including population growth, this is the business as usual, we're getting more and more into ecological debt. And this is not evenly distributed. Essentially, you can define sustainability as one planet living, but if people are living way beyond their allotted share, I mean, somebody somewhere else is not getting their fair share. Northern Ireland, taken as a whole, is living a 2.5 planet lifestyle. In other words, if everybody in the world was to live like us, to live in Northern Ireland, we'd need another planet and a half to sustain the resources and to absorb the pollution. So what we have to do is not go on this path and start peak and then gradually get back to a sustainable level. And ideally, to actually start building up some ecological reserves. We are rivet-popping the life-sustaining systems of the planet, and we're calling it progress. And this is unevenly distributed in terms of the development that all of this frantic activity in a global capitalist system produces. So we have the northern world, internet users, and deaths by often preventable starvation, completely the opposite. We live in a profoundly unjust as well as a profoundly unsustainable world. This adjusted map here is showing who are the culprits in degrading the natural life-supporting systems of the planet. It isn't people in Africa, generally, or even India. In comparison, look at Britain and Ireland in terms of our overuse of the world's resources. So I put it to you that we do have a population problem. Too many rich, fat Europeans and North Americans. Given that we, in the minority world of Europe, Australasia and Japan, are using up way more resources and causing more pollution, climate change and so on, than comparable populations on the planet. And here is our dilemma. Our good environmentalist respectfully saying, since the late 1960s, we think there's a problem. There's a cliff down there, don't go down it. And you could say that all the reports we've had since then, I mean, it's been raining reports for 40 years, telling us there's a major problem in terms of these limits, these ecological limits to growth. And we could be the first species to accurately document our own demise in terms of the reports. We don't need any more reports. In fact, we don't need any more technology, I would suggest as well, in terms of dealing with this transition from unsustainability. Because effectively, our economy is killing the planet. We're rivet-popping the life support systems of the planet and calling it progress. A quote there from Tim Jackson from 2008. And this is what's animated me for the last decade and probably will for the rest of my academic career, of trying to figure out if this system is unsustainable and unjust, well, what replaces it? Because we never had to create an economy which had to be so conscious of energy flows. And with due deference to colleague Dr. Robin Curry, we need, in his words, to become carbon literate. And I think that's what we're at now. The issue of the literacy of our economic system and indeed of citizens in terms of looking at flows of carbon and energy as an important part of looking at the economy, not just flows of money and employment. You may say, oh, that's terribly doom and gloom, John. What about technology? It'll solve our problem. And I am not a Luddite. I do believe in technological innovation can begin to help us in this transition from unsustainability. But I reject comprehensively the myth of decoupling. The idea that we can still have all the goodies that we have. Simon Cowell, X Factor, iPhone 6 that bends in your back pocket, YouTube, internet, pears from Guatemala flown in. The idea that we can have that lifestyle that's extremely high carbon, high energy, and high in pollution by decoupling it is a myth. But it's a very comforting myth. Because what this does is allows us to continue with our continuing unsustainable way of life without having to really change anything. These are figures from Tim Jackson. This is the trend growth, although it's a bit old now, 2007, of the connection, the absolute connection, causal connection between coal, CO2, gas, oil, and world GDP. Literally, carbon fuels the capitalist economy. So in terms of gigatons of carbon intensity and dollars, we're at this stage in 2007. Now, according to the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which recently released its latest assessment report, we need to get down here. So we're up here at the minute in terms of carbon intensity. If we want to stay below a 2-degree increase in global average temperature, which is probably the highest level we can go to stay within a safe operating space for humanity, I think we're not going to make it. And we're now into the scenario of an above 2-degree increase, which can lead to runaway climate change. Anyway, so we have to get from here down to here. Now, if we do that in terms of technology, what that means is it's a factor of 130 improvement. This is science fiction. To think that we can get from there to there by only dealing in technology and production. At some point, we're going to have to challenge consumption. That's the real inconvenient truth of a lot of the message of unsustainability. We cannot innovate and use technology to get us out of these problems. And as I'll come back towards the end of my talk, these type of technological solutions not only continue with business as usual, they also rob us of the ethical and political opportunity to reshape the world. That's why it's called business as usual. So what we have to do is, I think, imagine a life beyond economic growth. But this is the act here, as Tim Jackson goes on to say, of lunatics, idealists, and revolutionary. And I'm all three. But I've got a professor in front of my name. And for me, what's interesting in terms of the sociological, the cultural, indeed you could say the psychological importance of economic growth, because normally growth is good. Growth means maturation. It means development. But the point, and I go back to this rather provocative statement, that's what cancer is. Cancer are cells that have grown beyond the threshold that they are healthy for the host. So in other words, growth continually is not healthy, as I only know too well. The issue here is, how do we get negative feedback mechanisms of where do we introduce the notion of sufficiency, of enough, rather than maximization? But this challenging growth is tantamount to a betrayal in our society. To challenge growth, you're seen as betraying society, because our societies are based upon the idea of continual economic growth. Or to use a rather provocative phrase, and I could have only come up with this from living in Northern Ireland, of disloyalty. You are a disloyal citizen for arguing against economic growth. And we've known this. Famous Limits to Growth report, 1972, or Tim Jackson's in 2009, and many, many reports in between based on science, just looking at the scientific evidence of the accumulation of unsustainability in the system. So therefore, I get three reasons for why I'm critical of growth. It's clearly unsustainable, this process of continual economic growth. It doesn't deal with inequality in society. It manages inequality. And as I said, it also has passed the point where it's not actually contributing in the overdeveloped world, the minority world of Europe, Australasia, and Japan. We don't need more growth. You know what we need? More redistribution. Northern Ireland is an incredibly rich society. Unfortunately, it's all out in Coultra. It's in the wrong place. So why don't we bring down to the village where if the weather gets cold, there are people who might have to make the awful decision to feed themselves or heat themselves. And yet we have people living in tremendous opulence just down the road from me. And that really is the old issue of socialism, of Marxism, of radicals, to say, what's wrong with this picture? We are an incredibly rich society. Why are we wanting more growth? Growth is not what's needed. Growth is needed in Africa, in Asia, in China, to bring people out of poverty. We have a billion members of the human family living on less than a dollar a day. That's where growth should be. We have already passed a point where growth is no longer aiding us in terms of our fulfillment of human flourishing. This then leads to three criteria to assess economic policy. If it's low carbon, if it increases rather than decreases, if it increases inequality, we don't want it. If it decreases inequality, it can be normatively accepted. And does it add or take away from human flourishing? So this is not a blanket criticism of economic growth. You can have pro-poor economic growth. You can have different models of unorthodox economic growth. The classic one being, of course, the Scandinavian economies with high levels of social security, high levels of taxes, of course. But there are forms of economic growth that are less inequitous than some of the ones we've suffered in the Anglo-Saxon world. But then, and with due deference both to John Woods and Peter Doran and some others who've done some work on this area of GDP, you know, are we measuring the right thing? Because what gets measured gets done. And our societies, our economic system, our political parties are obsessed with GDP, economic growth. And GDP is simply a measure of all goods and services produced within a country. Includes things like beer, bicycles, education. I wouldn't recommend combining these two, as happened to me once upon a time while at Keele University. But this also adds to GDP. Divorce, ching ching. Pollution. Wars. All of these add to GDP. Negatives, I would say. We don't want more divorce in society. We want to certainly reduce pollution, and we don't want any more wars. Yet this adds to GDP. And what doesn't GDP measure? The feminized, gender unequal, reproductive labour and work that goes on in the home. That's not included in our GDP figures. Community activism, the convivial economy, of people getting together and exchanging and trading and working together about the use of money, doesn't get counted. Our democratic work as citizens to keep alive the ideals of living in a free and equal society, that doesn't count in our GDP figures. So it seems to me, if this measure of GDP doesn't measure the good stuff, why are we still building our economies around it? Why are our citizens getting a daily diet in the media of this constant encouragement to us, to our hearts, to sing or to drop if GDP is up or down? So what we need to do is get beyond this particular orthodox method. And this post-growth vision that I'm articulating, it is consistent with some sectors of the economy growing. I personally want to see more libraries, more kidney dialysis machine, more support for dancing. Mags burn here. I want less money for weapons. I want less money for bad things, you could say, in society. So a non-growing or a post-growth economy is consistent with some sectors of the economy growing and others shrinking. It's a political decision. So we'll get back, this is political economy. Not that it's somehow automatically given by fiat. And again, this is not particularly new. This is Robert Kennedy in 1968 at a commencement speech, shortly before he was assassinated. I think he put it very elegantly and eloquently of what's wrong with the GDP measure. In fact, if I had longer, I could bore you even more with some of the Foucauldian work I've done in looking at the origins of GDP and my argument that GDP lies in the mid-war period of the 1920s and 1930s, and Tom here might put me right. It measures the war-fighting capacity of a nation. That's what I was originally created to do. It was never set up, even by one of its greatest originators, Simon Kuznets, he even said that this GDP measure was not a measure of social welfare or how well society was doing. It was a technical measure, in one case, of the war-fighting capacity of society, but the measurement of goods and services traded in an economy. It's time to move beyond GDP as well as economic growth. But even more provocatively, if your heads aren't melted enough, the economy growing tells us nothing about the quality of economic activity. More people smoking and dying and having to access services because of it, that adds to GDP. So just looking at the GDP figure growing tells us nothing about the quality of economic activity. And the point also, rather provocatively from the New Economics Foundation, is that even in times of austerity and economic crisis, health and well-being, aspects of health and well-being can increase. In other words, there's no correlation necessary between orthodox GDP, health, human flourishing and well-being. And if you're interested, there's a local example of this, is that a report was done by the ONS, the Organisation for National Statistics in the UK, and they show that, I think it was of the five top quality of life places in the UK, three or four of them were in Northern Ireland. And yet our economy is often seen as a basket case. We have to rebalance the economy because the public sector is too big. We don't have enough foreign direct investment coming in. Too many small to medium enterprises and so on. So if our economy is such a basket case, why is it that we have recorded very high levels of quality of life? That's a paradox, one that I hope to embark upon in terms of trying to research it. Is it as glib that, well, we're all so happy we're not killing each other anymore? And I won't dismiss that, but here we are now, 15, 16 years after the agreement. Is there something else? Has it got to do with our high levels of social capital? In reference to Dr. Simon Bridge, Professor Simon Bridge, sorry, in the audience. Has it got to do with our levels of conviviality, which can be often horribly sectarianised, of course. You know, we've lots of bonding capital between us, not a lot of bridging often. But it's a conundrum. Why is it that the Northern Ireland economy, seen as such a basket case, actually tends to produce high levels of quality of life, according to this particular survey? And this is, if I can make a contribution to the academy, it's this phrase, is questioning the idea of undifferentiated. So we have to differentiate. Do we want prostitution in our economy? Well, maybe not. So right, we want to differentiate that, even if it's legalised or not. Do we want to have war making as part of the economy that we're going to measure? Do we want to see that we have to make awful choices between spending money on better ways to kill each other as opposed to sustain our lives? So we have to get smarter in terms of differentiating which bits of the economy do we want to grow and why. And that cannot be answered technically. That is not a technical question. That's a moral and political issue. But it's also about questioning economic growth as a permanent feature of the economy. I am perfectly willing and happy to accept that growth historically has led us to the affluent societies that we have today. But to say that we continue on this path when it's long past the point of being ecologically sustainable, that it adds to human flourishing, or that it reduces and starts to ameliorate the inequalities in society is an issue we haven't really begun yet. What this means then, to go back to the point I made earlier about carbon literacy, we're going to have to set up new systems of accounts where we're measuring and tracking flows of resources, of pollution, of carbon. And we have many of these models already, but they're just not being scaled up or been implemented or promoted to citizens. This is the new economy. What we're facing here, in my view, is a paradigm shift. We're at that moment of crisis from which a paradigm shift needs to occur. But I've been saying this for 30 years. The issue is, we're saying it louder, we've got better statistics, we have more reports, but still the politicians, but also citizens, don't want to listen. And there's an issue there about how you present this in terms of a compelling, attractive vision to live in a different type of society. The other reason why economic growth under capitalism is unjust and unsustainable is because of this myth of trickle-down economics, which I think John Kenneth Galbraith put it most succinctly. This is the justification for inequalities. The titans of industry and finance, they'll be taxed modestly. Or if you're Google, maybe you can negotiate with the Irish government and get it down to really, really low. And that will then pass on to little people. Because only little people pay taxes. And in fact, if the UK government has its way, we'll have less tax inspectors. In fact, that's the one thing that could help us get out of this crisis. Invest more in tax inspectors. Close up those offshore loopholes that allow large corporations and high-wealth individuals to avoid tax. And Bono, move U2's accounts back to Ireland, not Holland. This is one for you, Mum. This is Shopaholic.